Give me some time, Rick said.
Okay,
Rachel said.
We'll leave you in here where it's comfortable.
Half an hour,
Elden Rosen said. He and Rachel filed toward the door of the room, silently. You managed to set me up perfectly, Rick said. You have it on tape that I missed on you. You know that my job depends on the use of the void comp scale, and you own the goddamn owl.
Your owl, dear,
Rachel said.
Remember? We'll tie your home address around its leg and have it fly down to San Francisco. It'll meet you when you get off work.
It, he thought. She keeps calling the owl it, not her. Just a second.
You've decided?
Rachel said. I want, he said, opening his briefcase, to ask you one more question from the void comp scale. Sit down again. Rachel glanced at her uncle. He nodded, and she grudgingly returned, seating herself as before. Presently, he had the pencil of light trained on her right eye and the adhesive patch again in contact with her cheek. Rachel stared into the light rigidly. My briefcase, Rick said as he rummaged for the void comp forms. Nice, isn't it? Department issue.
Well, well,
Rachel said. Baby hide, Rick said. He stroked the black leather surface of the briefcase. 100% genuine human baby hide. He saw the two dial indicators gyrate frantically, but only after a pause. The reaction had come, but too late. Thanks, Miss Rosen, he said, and gathered together the equipment. That's all.
You're leaving?
Rachel asked. Yes, he said. I'm satisfied.
What about the other subjects?
Rachel said. The scale has been adequate in your case. I can extrapolate from that. It's clearly still effective. To Elden Rosen, who slumped morosely in the door of the room, he said, Does she know? Sometimes they didn't. False memories had been tried various times, generally in the mistaken idea that through them reactions to testing would be altered.
No, Elden Rosen said. We programmed her completely. But I think toward the end she suspected.
To the girl, he said,
You guessed when he asked for one more try.
Pale, Rachel nodded fixedly.
Don't be afraid of him. You're not an escaped android on Earth illegally. You're the property of the Rosen Association, used as a sales device for prospective immigrants.
He's right, Rick said. I'm not going to retire you, Miss Rosen. Good day. He started toward the door, then halted briefly. Is this owl genuine? Rachel glanced swiftly at the elder Rosen.
He's leaving anyhow, Elden Rosen said. It doesn't matter. The owl is artificial. There are no owls.
Rick stepped numbly out into the corridor. No wonder law enforcement agencies were having so much trouble with the Nexus 6. Rachel, he realized, she must be a Nexus 6. I'm seeing one of them for the first time, and they damn near did it. They came awfully damn close to undermining the void comp scale, the only method we have for detecting them. And I have to face 6 more of them, he reflected, before I'm finished. He would earn the bounty money, every cent, assuming he made it through alive. The TV set boomed, descending the great empty apartment building's dust-stricken stairs to the level below. John Isidore made out now the familiar voice of Buster Friendly, burbling happily to his system-wide vast audience. As Isidore knocked on the apartment door, the television died immediately into non-being.
Hey, he called. I live upstairs. I heard your TV. Let's meet, okay?
He waited, listening.
I brought you a cube of margarine, he said. My name's J.R. Isidore, and I work for the well-known animal vet Mr. Hannibal Sloat. I'm reputable. I have a job. I drive Mr. Sloat's truck.
The door, meagerly, opened, and he saw within the apartment a girl who cringed and slunk away.
You thought no one lived in this building, he said. You thought it was abandoned.
Nodding, the girl whispered,
Yes.
But, Isidore said, it's good to have neighbors. Heck, until you came along, I didn't have any.
You're the only one?
The girl asked.
In this building besides me?
She seemed less timid now. He saw that she had a nice figure, although small, and nice eyes markedly established by long black eyelashes.
I'm the only one besides you, Isidore said, and I won't bother you.
He felt glum. His offering, possessing the quality of an authentic old pre-war ritual, had not been accepted. In fact,
the girl did not even seem aware of it. "Good old Buster," he said. "You like him?"
"Who?"
she began. "Buster Friendly," he explained. It seemed odd to him that this girl had never heard of the Earth's most knee-slapping TV comic. "Where did you say you come from?" he asked.
"I don't see that it matters. I'll be glad to receive company later on when I'm more moved in. Right now, of course, it's out of the question."
"Why out of the question? I could help you unpack," he ventured. The door, now, had virtually shut in his face. "And your furniture?"
"I have no furniture. All these things, they were here."
"They won't do," Isidore said. He could tell that at a glance. The chairs, the carpet, the tables, all had rotted away. "Listen," he said. "If we go all over the building looking, we can probably find the things that aren't so tattered. A lamp from one apartment, a table from another."
"I'll do it. Myself. Thanks."
"You'd go into those apartments alone?"
"Why not?"
Again she shuddered nervously, grimacing in awareness of saying something wrong. "I've tried it," Isidore said. "Once. After that, I just come home and go in my place and I don't think about the rest. The apartments in which no one lives, hundreds of them and all full of the possessions people had, like family photographs and clothes. Those that died couldn't take anything and those that immigrated didn't want to. This building, except for my apartment, is completely kippelized."
"Kippelized?"
She did not comprehend. "Kipple is useless objects, like junk mail or gum wrappers. When nobody's around, kipple reproduces itself."
"I see."
The girl regarded him uncertainly. "There's the first law of kipple," he said. "Kipple drives out non-kipple. And in these apartments, there's been nobody there to fight the kipple."
"So it has taken over completely,"
the girl finished.
"Now I understand."
"Your place here," he said. "This apartment you've picked, it's too kippelized to live in. We can roll the kipple factor back. We can do, like I said, raid the other apartments, but..."
"But what?"
"We can't win," Isidore said.
"Why not?"
The girl stepped into the hall. "No one can win against kipple," he said. "It's a universal principle. The entire universe is moving toward a final state of total, absolute kippelization. Except, of course, for the upward climb of Wilbur Mercer." The girl eyed him.
"I don't see any relation."
"That's what Mercerism is all about. Don't you participate in fusion? Don't you own an empathy box?"
"I didn't bring mine with me. I assumed I'd find one here."
"But an empathy box is the most personal possession you have. It's an extension of your body. It's the way you touch other humans. It's the way you stop being alone. But you know that. Everybody knows that. Mercer even lets people like me..." He broke off, but too late. He had already told her, and he could see by her face, by the flicker of sudden aversion, that she knew. "I almost passed the IQ test," he said. "I'm not very special, only moderately. Not like some, you see. But that's what Mercer doesn't care about."
"As far as I'm concerned,"
the girl said,
"you can count that as a major objection to Mercerism."
"I guess I'll go back upstairs," he said. The girl watched him go, and then...
"Wait."
"Why?"
"I'll need you. For getting myself adequate furniture from other apartments, as you said. What time do you get home from work? You can help me then."
"Could you maybe fix dinner for us?" Isidore said. "If I brought home the ingredients?"
"No. Some other time."
The girl moved back toward her apartment door. "Did you get my name? John Isidore, and I work for..."
"You told me who you work for. Some incredible person named Hannibal Sloats, who I'm sure doesn't exist outside your imagination. My name is... I'm Rachel Rosen."
"Of the Rosen Association? The system's largest manufacturer of humanoid robots used in the colonization program?"
"No. No, I never heard of them. I don't know anything about it. More of your chicken-head imagination, I suppose."
"But your name suggests..."
"My name is Pris Stratton. That's my married name. I always use it. I never use any other name but Pris. You can call me Pris. No, you'd better address me as Miss Stratton, because we don't really know each other. At least, I don't know you."
The door shut after her,
and he found himself alone in the dust-strewn hall. Well, so it goes, J.R. Isidore thought. Maybe she'll change her mind. She's really out of touch, he thought. For instance, she's never heard of Buster Friendly, and that's impossible. Buster is the most important human being alive, except, of course, for Wilbur Mercer. But Mercer, he reflected, isn't a human being. He evidently is an archetypal entity from the stars. But something about Buster Friendly irritated John Isidore. Why did Buster Friendly always chip away at Mercerism? No one else seemed bothered by it. Our minds, Isidore decided, they're fighting for control of our psychic selves. The empathy box on one hand, Buster's guffaws on the other. After parking the department's speedy, beefed-up hover car on the roof of the San Francisco Hall of Justice, bounty hunter Rick Deckard, briefcase in hand, descended to Harry Bryant's office. You're back awfully soon, his superior said. I got what you sent me for. Rick seated himself facing the desk. He set his briefcase down. How's Dave? He asked. Well enough for me to talk to him? I want to before I tackle the first of the Andes. You'll be trying for Polakov first, Bryant said. The one that lasered Dave. Best to get him right out of it, since he knows we've got him listed. Bryant reached for a sheet of onion skin paper, a blurred third or fourth carbon. Polakov has taken a job as a trash collector, a scavenger. Don't only specials do that kind of work? Polakov is mimicking a special. Are you sure about this void comp scale now? You're absolutely certain, from what happened up in Seattle, that... I am, Rick said. He did not amplify. I'll take your word for it, but there can't be even one slip-up. There never could be in Andy hunting. This is no different. The Nexus 6 is different. I already found my first one, Rick said, and Dave found two. Three, if you count Polakov. Okay, I'll retire Polakov today. He reached for the blurred carbon, the poop sheet on the android Polakov. One more item, Bryant said. A Soviet cop from the WPO is on his way here. While you were in Seattle, I got a call from him. Sandor Kadalyi is his name. What's he want? WPO is interested enough in the new Nexus 6 types that they want a man of theirs to be with you, an observer, and also, if he can, he'll assist you. It's for you to decide when and if he can be of value, but I've already given him the permission to tag along. Rick studied the poop sheet on Polakov. It gave a description of the man, or rather the Andy, and his current address in the place of business, the Bay Area Scavengers Company. Want to wait on the Polakov retirement until the Soviet cop gets here to help you? Brian asked. Rick bristled. I've always worked alone. Of course, it's your decision. I'll do whatever you say. But I'd just as soon tackle Polakov right now, without waiting for Kadalyi to hit town. You go ahead on your own, Brian decided. And then on the next one, which will be Miss Luba Luft, you have the sheet on her too. You can bring in Kadalyi. For his first try at the android Polakov, Rick stopped off at the offices of the Bay Area Scavengers Company. I'm looking for an employee of yours, he said to the gray-haired switchboard woman.
Mr. Ackers.
The switchboard woman informed him.
He's the personnel manager.
She pointed to an imitation oak desk at which sat a prissy, bespectacled individual, merged with his plethora of paperwork. Rick presented his police ID. Where's your employee Polakov right now? At his job or at home?
Polakov ought to be at work, Mr. Ackers said. However,
he picked up his vidphone and made an inside call.
He's not then?
He said.
Polakov didn't show up for work today. No explanation. What's he done, officer?
If he should show up, Rick said, don't tell him I was here asking about him. You understand? Rick flew to Polakov's apartment building in the Tenderloin. What a grimy place, he observed as he walked across the roof to the elevator. He descended to Polakov's floor, found the hall unlit, like a subterranean cave. Using his police A-powered sealed beam light, he illuminated the hall and once again glanced over the onion skin carbon. The void comp test had been administered to Polakov. That part could be bypassed, and he could go directly to the task of destroying the android. Using an infinity key, which analyzed and opened all forms of locks known, he entered Polakov's apartment, laser beam in hand. No Polakov, only semi-ruined furniture, a place of kibble and decay. I knew it, he said to himself. Well, there goes the first $1,000 bounty. Probably skipped all the way to the Antarctic Circle. Back again on the roof, in his hover car, he reported by phone to Harry Bryant. No luck on Polakov. Left probably right after he lasered Dave. He inspected his wristwatch. Want me to pick up Kadalia at the field? It'll save time, and I'm eager to get started on Miss Luft. He already had the poop sheet on her laid out before him. Good idea, Bryant said, except that Mr. Kadalia is already here. He'll fly over and meet you. Meanwhile, read up on Miss Luft, an opera singer, allegedly from Germany, at present attached to the San Francisco Opera Company. Rick nodded. Must have a good voice to make connections so fast, he said. Okay, I'll wait here for Kadalia. He gave Bryant his location and rang off. I'll pose as an opera fan, Rick decided as he read further. In my personal collection, I have tapes by such old-time greats as Elizabeth Schwarzkopf, Lotta Lehmann, and Lisa Della Casa. That'll give us something to discuss while I set up the Void Comp equipment. His car phone buzzed.
Mr. Deckard, a call for you from Seattle. Mr. Bryan said to put it through to you from the Rosen Association.
Okay, Rick said, and waited. What do they want, he wondered. Rachel Rosen's face appeared on the tiny screen.
Hello, Officer Deckard. Are you busy right now, or can I talk to you?
Go ahead, he said.
We of the Association have been discussing your situation regarding the escaped Nexus 6 types. And knowing them as we do, we feel that you'll have better luck if one of us works in conjunction with you.
By doing what?
Well, by one of us coming along with you. The Nexus 6s would be wary at being approached by a human. But if another Nexus 6 made the contact...
You specifically mean yourself?
Yes.
I've got too much help already.
But I really think you need me.
I doubt it. I'll think it over and call you back. At some distant, unspecified future time, he said to himself. Or more likely, never. He started to hang up.
Without me,
Rachel said.
One of them will get you before you can get it.
Goodbye, he said and hung up. As he resumed reading the poop sheet on Luba Luft, a hover car taxi spun down to land on the roof a few yards off. From it, a red-faced, cherubic-looking man, evidently in his mid-50s, stepped and smiling approached Rick's car.
Mr. Deckard, the bounty hunter for the San Francisco Police Department? I'm Sandor Kadalia.
He opened the car door to squeeze in beside Rick. As he shook hands with Kadalia, Rick noticed that the WPO representative carried an unusual type of laser tube, which he had never seen before.
Interesting, isn't it? Kadalia said. I got this on Mars.
I thought I knew every kind of handgun made, Rick said.
We made this ourselves, Kadalia said, beaming.
You like it?
What is different about it, functionally, is...
Here, take it. He passed the gun over to Rick. How does it differ functionally, Rick asked.
Press the trigger.
Aiming upward out of the car window, Rick squeezed the trigger of the weapon. Nothing happened. No beam emerged. Puzzled, he turned to Kadalia.
The triggering circuit isn't attached. It remains with me, you see?
He opened his hand, revealed a tiny unit.
And I can also direct it, within certain limits, irrespective of where it's aimed.
You're Polakov, the android. You're not from the Soviet police. With his toe, Rick pressed the emergency button on the floor of his car.
Why won't my laser tube fire?
Kadalia, Polakov said, switching on and off his miniaturized device in the palm of his hand. A sine wave that phases out laser emanation and spreads the beam into ordinary light.
Then I'll have to break your pencil neck.
The android dropped the device and with a snarl grabbed with both hands for Rick's throat. As the android's hand sank into his throat, Rick fired his regulation-issue old-style pistol from its shoulder holster. The .38 Magnum slug struck the android in the head and its brain box burst. The Nexus 6 unit, which operated it, blew into pieces, a raging mad wind which carried throughout the car. Bits of it, like the radioactive dust itself, whirled down on Rick. He found himself struggling to shove the twitching remnants of the android away. Shakily, he reached for the phone. He placed a call home. His wife's face, sodden with the 6-hour depression, manifested itself on the vidscreen.
Oh, hello, Rick.
What happened to the 594 I dialed for you before I left? Pleased acknowledgement of...
I redialed as soon as you left. What do you want? I'm so tired and I just have no hope left of anything. Of our marriage and you possibly getting killed by one of those Andes. Is that what you want to tell me, Rick? That an Andy got you?
Listen, can you hear me? I'm on to something. A new type of android that apparently nobody can handle but me. I've retired one already, so that's a grand to start with. You know what we're going to have before I'm through? Iran stared at him sightlessly.
Oh,
she said, nodding. He could tell now. Her depression this time had become too vast for her even to hear him. I'll see you tonight. He finished and slammed the receiver down. Damn her. What good does it do, my risking my life? I wish I had gotten rid of her 2 years ago when we were considering splitting up. I can still do it, he reminded himself. Broodingly, he leaned down, gathered together his crumpled papers, including the info on Luba Luft. No support, he informed himself. Most androids I've known have more vitality and desire to live than my wife. She has nothing to give me. That made him think of Rachel Rosen again. Her advice as to the Nexus 6 mentality, he realized, turned out to be correct. Assuming she doesn't want any of the bounty money, maybe I could use her. Snapping on his hover car's engine, he whisked nippity-nip up into the sky, heading toward the old War Memorial Opera House where, according to Dave Holden's notes, he would find Luba Luft this time of day. He wondered now about her, too. Some female androids seemed to him pretty. He found himself physically attracted by several, and it was an odd sensation, knowing intellectually that they were machines but emotionally reacting anyhow. For example, Rachel Rosen. No, he decided, she's too thin. He could do better. How old did the poop sheet say Luba Luft was? 28, the sheet read, judged by appearance, which, with Andy's, was the only useful standard. I'll try one more Andy before I ask Rachel for help, he decided, if Miss Luft proves exceptionally hard. In the old opera house, Rick Deckard found an echoing, noisy rehearsal taking place. As he entered, he recognized the music. Mozart's The Magic Flute. On the stage, Luba Luft sang, and he found himself surprised at the quality of her voice. It rated with that of the best, even that of the notables in his collection of historic tapes. The Rosen Association had built her well, he had to admit. At the end of rehearsal, Rick made his way backstage. Stopping a super, he asked for Miss Luft's dressing room. Rick arrived at the indicated door, saw a note tacked to it reading, Miss Luft, private, and knocked.
Come in.
He entered. The girl sat at her dressing table. She still wore her costume and makeup. The stage makeup enlarged her eyes. Enormous and hazel, they fixed on him and did not waver.
Yes,
she said.
I am busy, as you can see.
Her English contained no remnant of an accent. You compare favorably to Schwarzkopf, Rick said.
Who are you?
I'm from the San Francisco Police Department.
Oh?
The huge and intense eyes did not respond.
What are you here about?
Seating himself in a nearby chair, he unzipped his briefcase. I have been sent here to administer a standard personality profile test to you. It won't take more than a few minutes.
Is it necessary? I have a good deal I must do.
It's necessary. He got out the void comp instruments, began setting them up.
An IQ test?
No. Empathy. I'll show you some pictures and ask you a few questions. Meanwhile, he got up and walked to her, and bending, pressed the adhesive pad of sensitive grids against her deeply tinted cheek.
Do you think I'm an android? Is that it? I'm not an android. I haven't even been on Mars. I've never even seen an android. Do you have information that there's an android in the cast? I'd be glad to help you, and if I were an android, would I be glad to help you?
An android, he said, doesn't care what happens to another android. That's one of the indications we look for.
Then,
Miss Luft said,
you must be an android.
That stopped him. He stared at her.
Because,
she continued,
your job is to kill them, isn't it? You're what they call
a bounty hunter, but I'm not an android. Let's get on with the test, he said, getting out his sheets of questions.
I'll take the test,
Luba Luft said,
if you'll take it first.
Again he stared at her, stopped in his tracks.
Wouldn't that be more fair?
She asked.
Then I could be sure of you. I don't know, you seem so peculiar.
You wouldn't be able to administer the void comp test. It takes considerable experience. Now please, listen carefully. These questions will deal with social situations which you might find yourself in. What I want from you is a statement of response as quickly as you can give it. One of the factors I'll record is the time lag, if any. He selected his initial question. You're sitting, watching TV, and suddenly you discover a wasp crawling on your wrist.
What's a wasp?
A stinging bug that flies.
Oh, how strange. Do they still exist? I've never seen one.
They died out because of the dust. Don't you really know what a wasp is? You must have been alive when there were wasps. That's only been...
Tell me the German word.
He tried to think of the German word for wasp, but couldn't. Your English is perfect,
he said.
My accent is perfect. It has to be for roles, but my vocabulary isn't very large.
Vesp, he said, remembering the German word.
Ach, yes, I'm Vesp. And what was the question? I forgot already.
Let's try another. You were watching an old movie on TV, a movie from before the war. It shows a banquet in progress. The entree, he skipped over the first part, consists of boiled dog stuffed with rice.
Nobody would kill and eat a dog. They're worth a fortune. But I guess it would be an imitation dog. But those are made of wires and motors. They can't be eaten.
Before the war.
I wasn't alive before the war.
But your response, he said. I want your social, emotional, moral reaction.
To the movie? I'd turn it off and watch Buster Friendly.
After a pause, he said, you're dating a man and he asks you to visit his apartment. While you're there...
Oh, nine, I wouldn't be there. That's easy to answer.
That's not the question.
Did you get the wrong question? But I understand that. Why is a question I understand the wrong one? Aren't I supposed to understand?
Nervously fluttering, she rubbed her cheek and detached the adhesive disc. It dropped to the floor, skidded and rolled under the dressing table.
Ach, Gott.
She muttered, bending to retrieve it. A ripping sound, that of cloth tearing, her elaborate costume. I'll get it, he said, and knelt down, groped under the dressing table until his fingers located the disc. When he stood up, he found himself looking into a laser tube.
Your questions,
Lubeloft said,
began to do with sex. I thought they would, finally. You're not from the police department. You're a sexual deviant.
You can look at my identification. He reached toward his coat pocket. His hand, he saw, had begun to shake.
If you reach in there,
Lubeloft said,
I'll kill you.
You will anyhow.
Let me see some more of your questions.
She held out her hand, and reluctantly, he passed her the sheets.
In a magazine, you come across a full-page color picture of a nude girl. Well, that's one. You became pregnant by a man who has promised to marry you. The pattern of your questioning is obvious. I'm going to call the police.
A few minutes later, during which Luba carefully kept the laser tube on him, a large harness bull arrived in his archaic blue uniform with gun and star.
All right, he said at once to Luba. Put that thing away.
She set down the laser tube and he picked it up. He returned to Rick.
Who are you?
He came into my dressing room,
Lubeloft said.
I've never seen him before in my life. He pretended to be taking a poll or something and he wanted to ask me questions. I thought it was all right and I said okay. And then he began asking me obscene questions.
Mm-hmm. Let's see your identification,
the harness bull said. I'm a bounty hunter with the department, Rick said as he got out his ID.
I know all the bounty hunters, the harness bull said as he examined Rick's wallet. And I've never heard of you.
He handed Rick's ID back to him. Call Inspector Bryant, Rick said.
There isn't any Inspector Bryant.
It came to Rick what was going on. You're an android, he said. Like Miss Luft. Going to the vidphone, he picked up the receiver himself. I'm going to call the department. He wondered how far he would get before the two androids stopped him. He dialed. Let me talk to Inspector Bryant. This is Rick Deckard. A pause, and then Harry Bryant's face appeared on the vidscreen. What's doing? He asked. Some trouble, Rick said. One of those on Dave's list managed to call in and get a so-called patrolman out here. I can't seem to prove to him who I am. He says he knows all the bounty hunters in the department and he's never heard of me. He hasn't heard of you either. Let me talk to him. Inspector Bryant wants to talk to you. Rick held out the vidphone receiver.
Officer Krams, the harness bull said. Hello?
He listened and said hello several more times, then turned to Rick.
There's nobody on the line and nobody on the screen.
He pointed to the vidphone screen, and Rick saw nothing on it. Taking the receiver from the harness bull, Rick said, Mr. Bryant? He listened, waited. Nothing. I'll dial again. The phone rang, but no one answered it.
Let me try, Officer Krams said. You must have misdialed. Officer Krams calling in. Is there an Inspector Bryant connected with the department?
Well, what about a bounty hunter named Rick Deckard?
You're sure? Could he have recently... Oh, I see. Okay, thanks. No, I have it under control.
Officer Krams rang off, turned toward Rick. I had him on the line, Rick said. I talked to him. He said he'd talk to you. It must be phone trouble.
I have Miss Luft's statement, Deckard, so let's go down to the Hall of Justice so I can book you.
Okay, Rick said. I'm anxious to get to the Hall of Justice. This matter should be straightened out. Officer Krams deftly frisked him and came up with Rick's service pistol and laser tube. He appropriated both after sniffing the muzzle of the pistol.
This has been fired recently.
I retired in Andy just now, Rick said. The remains are still in my car,
up on the roof.
Okay, Officer Cram said. We'll go have a look. He nudged Rick forward, and together, the two of them ascended by elevator to the roof of the opera house. Opening the door of Rick's car, Officer Krams inspected the body of Polakov. An android, Rick said. I was sent after him. He almost got me, pretending to be. They'll take your statement at the Hall of Justice, Officer Krams interrupted. He nudged Rick over to the police car. With the two of them aboard, the patrol car zoomed up and headed south. Something, Rick noticed, was not as it should be. The Hall of Justice, he said, is north, on Lombard. That's the old Hall of Justice, Officer Cram said. The new one is on Mission. That old building, nobody's used that for years. The Mission Street Hall of Justice building struck Rick Deckard as attractive, except for one aspect. He had never seen it before. A few minutes later, he found himself being booked. It makes no sense, he said to himself. Who are these people? If this place has always existed, why didn't we know about it? And why don't they know about us? A man, not in uniform, approached Rick Deckard. What's this one? He asked. Suspected homicide, Krams answered. We have a body. We found in his car, but he claims it's an android. We're giving it a bone marrow analysis in the lab, and posing as a bounty hunter, to gain access to a woman's dressing room in order to ask her suggestive questions. She doubted he was what he said he was and called us in. You want to finish up with him, sir? All right. The senior police official eyed Rick and reached for Rick's briefcase. What do you have in here, Mr. Deckard? Material pertaining to the Voight-Kampff personality test. I was testing a suspect when Officer Krams arrested me. He watched as the police official rummaged through the contents of the briefcase. The questions I asked Miss Luff are standard VK questions printed on the... Do you know George Gleason and Phil Resch? The police official asked. No, Rick said. They're the bounty hunters of Northern California. Both are attached to our department. Maybe you'll run into them while you're here. Are you an android, Mr. Deckard? The reason I ask is we've had escaped Andes turn up posing as out-of-state bounty hunters here in pursuit of a suspect. I'm not an android. You can administer the Voight-Kampff test to me. I've taken it before. Can I phone my wife? You're allowed one call. Would you rather phone her than a lawyer? I'll phone my wife. She can get a lawyer for me. The plainclothes officer handed him a 50-cent piece. Rick dialed his home phone number and stood for what seemed like an eternity, waiting. A woman's face appeared on the vid screen.
Hello?
She said. It was not Iran. He had never seen the woman before in his life. He hung up, walked slowly back to the police officer. Here's your briefcase, the officer said. Come into my office. I'd like to talk with you further. He started down the hall, leading the way. My name is Garland, the police officer said. He held out his hand and they shook, briefly. Sit down, Garland said as he opened his office door. This Voight-Kampff test that you mentioned, all that material you carry, it's an analytical tool for detecting Andes? It's our basic test, the only one we currently employ, the only one capable of distinguishing the new Nexus 6 brain unit. You haven't heard of this test? I've heard of several profile analysis scales for use with androids, but not that one. He continued to study Rick intently. Those smudged carbon flimsies that you have in your briefcase, Polakov, Miss Luft, your assignments. The next one is me. Rick stared at him, then grabbed for the briefcase. In a moment, the carbons lay spread out before him. Garland had told the truth. It's an unpleasant sensation, Garland said, to find yourself a bounty hunter's assignment all of a sudden. Or whatever it is you are, Deckard. He pressed the key on his desk intercom. Send one of the bounty hunters in here. I don't care which one. Okay, thank you. Phil Resch will be in here in a minute or so from now, he said to Rick. I want to see his list before I proceed. You think I might be on his list? Rick said. It's possible. We'll know pretty soon. Best to be sure about these critical matters. The office door opened and a tall man wearing horn-rimmed glasses and a fuzzy Van Dyke beard appeared. Garland rose. Phil Resch, Rick Deckard. You're both bounty hunters, and it's probably time you met. Which city are you attached to? Phil Resch said as he shook hands with Rick. Garland answered. San Francisco. Here, take a look at his schedule. This one comes up next. He handed Phil Resch the sheet which Rick Deckard had been examining. Say, Gar, this is you. There's more. He's also got Luba Luft, the opera singer, on his list, and Polakov. Remember Polakov? He's now dead. This bounty hunter, or android, or whatever he is, got him. We're running a bone marrow test. Polakov I've talked to, Phil Resch said. Luba Luft I've never met, although I've heard records she's made. To Rick, he said, did you test her out? I started to, but I couldn't get an accurate reading, and she called in a harness bull, which ended it. What test do you use? Phil Resch asked. The Void Kampf scale. I don't know that particular one. I've always said that the best place for an android would be with a big police organization such as WPO. Ever since I first met Polakov, I wanted to test him, but no pretext ever arose. It never would have either, which is one of the values such a spot would have for an enterprising android. The intercom came on.
Inspector Garland, the lab report on Mr. Polakov's corpse is ready.
Let's have it, Miss French.
The bone marrow test shows that Mr. Polakov was a humanoid robot. Do you want a detailed...
Nah, that's enough. Garland settled back in his seat, grimly contemplating the far wall. He said nothing. Resch said, what is the basis of your Void Kampf test, Mr. Deckard? Empathic response, in a variety of social situations, mostly having to do with animals. Ours is probably simpler, Resch said. The reflex arc response taking place in the upper ganglia of the spinal column requires several microseconds more in the humanoid robot than in the human nervous system. We use an audio signal, or light flash. The subject presses a button, and the elapsed time is measured. We try it a number of times, of course. Elapsed time varies both in Andy and the human, but by the time 10 reactions have been measured, we believe we have a reliable clue. You can test me out, Rick said. I'm ready. Of course, I'd like to test you, too, if you're willing. Naturally, Resch said. He was, however, studying Inspector Garland. I've said for years that the Bonelli reflex arc test should be applied routinely to police personnel. The higher up the chain of command, the better. Haven't I, Inspector? That's right, you have, Garland said. And I've always opposed it, on the grounds that it would lower department morale. I think now, Rick said, you're going to have to sit still for it, in view of your lab's report on Polakov. I guess so, Garland said. He jabbed a finger at Phil Resch. But I'm warning you, you're not going to like the results of the tests. Do you know what they'll be? Resch asked. I know almost to a hair, Inspector Garland said. Okay, Resch nodded. I'll go upstairs and get the Bonelli gear. I'll be back in 3 or 4 minutes. Reaching into the top right-hand drawer of his desk, Inspector Garland fumbled about, then brought forth a laser tube. He swiveled it at Rick. That's not going to make any difference, Rick said. Resch will have a post-mortem run on me, the same as your lab ran on Polakov, and he'll insist on the Bonelli test on himself and on you. By degrees, Garland lowered the laser beam. Then he shrugged and returned it to the desk drawer. What will the test on the three of us show? Rick asked. That damn fool, Resch, Garland said. He actually doesn't know? He doesn't know. He doesn't suspect. He doesn't have the slightest idea. Otherwise, he couldn't live out his life as a bounty hunter, a human occupation, hardly an android occupation. Garland gestured toward Rick's briefcase. Those other carbons, the other suspects you're supposed to test and retire, we all came here together on the same ship from Mars. Not Resch. He stayed behind another week, receiving the synthetic memory system. What'll he do when he finds out? I don't have the foggiest idea. He may kill me. Kill himself. Maybe you too. Your position would be better if Phil Resch could pass the Bonelli test, if it was just me. That way, the results would be predictable. To Resch, I'd just be another Andy to retire as soon as possible. So you're not in a good position either, Deckard. Almost as bad, in fact, as I am. When I phoned my apartment, Rick said, why didn't I get my wife? All our vidphone lines here are trapped. They recirculate the call to the other offices within the building. This is a homeostatic enterprise we're operating, Deckard. We're a closed loop, cut off from the rest of San Francisco. We know about them, but they don't know about us. Sometimes an isolated person wanders in here, or, as in your case, is brought here for our protection. The office door opened. Phil Resch stood, carrying a device which trailed wires. Here we are, he said. He seated himself, plugging the device into the electrical outlet. Bringing out his right hand, Garland pointed at Resch,
At once, Resch, and also Rick Deckard, rolled from their chairs and onto the floor. At the same time, Resch yanked a laser tube, and as he fell, fired at Garland. The laser beam bifurcated Inspector Garland's head. He slumped forward. From his hand, his miniaturized laser beam rolled across the surface of his desk. "It forgot," Resch said, "that this is my job. I can almost foretell what an android is going to do. I suppose you can, too." He put his laser beam away and examined the body of his quondam superior. "What did it say to you while I was gone?" "That it was an android, and you would detect it in a few more minutes." "Anything else?" "This building is android-infested. That's going to make it hard for you and me to get out of here. Nominally, I have the authority to leave any time I want, of course, and to take a prisoner with me. You realize, don't you, that you're going to have to double back to the Opera House to get Luba Luft before anyone here has a chance to warn her as to how this came out. Warn it, I should say." "All right, I'll head directly back to the Opera House, assuming you can get me out of here." Pressing a key on the desk intercom, Phil Resch said, "Inspector Garland has asked that no calls be put through to him for the next half hour. He's involved in work that can't be interrupted."
"Yes, Mr. Resch."
Releasing the intercom key, Phil Resch said to Rick, "I'm going to handcuff you to me during the time we're still in the building. Once we're airborne, I'll naturally let you go." He produced a pair of cuffs, slapped one onto Rick's wrist and the other around his own. "Come on, let's get it over with." The elevator ceased rising. Its doors slid back, and there, spread out ahead of them, lay the police station's roof field. "Here's my car," Phil Resch said, unlocking the door of the nearby hover car. In a moment they had lifted into the sky, headed back in the direction of the War Memorial Opera House. Preoccupied, Phil Resch drove by reflex. "Listen, Deckard, after we retire Luba Luft, I want you, you know, give me the Bonelli test, or that empathy scale that you have, to see about me." "We can worry about that later," Rick said. "You don't want me to take it, do you? I guess you know what the results will be. Garland must have told you something. Facts which I don't know." "It's going to be hard," Rick said, "even for the two of us to take Luba Luft. She's more than I could handle anyhow. Let's keep our attention focused on that."
"It's not just the false memory structures," Phil Resch said. "I own an animal. Not a false one, but the real thing. A squirrel. I love that squirrel, Deckard.